For the week of May 28th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 368, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. Back in Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz. You had Khan, but I have Fleet Week, Sailors versus Cinema.
I think that's the reason you actually stayed in New York rather than go to Cannes this year.
It's actually one thing I did miss when I would go to Cannes. I did miss Fleet Week. Fleet Week's a lot of fun. You feel like you're on a big old movie set because there are sailors in white riding down the street, singing and laughing, breaking into song, dancing. No, wait, that's just in my head.
Yeah, but they are in white walking down the street. I do remember that about Fleet Week. Yeah, it's always like, what? I didn't know there were this many sailors in the world.
And of course, while they're in the city, walking down the street, or in the subways, they're going to be listening to podcasts. And when they listen to Showbiz Sandbox, what will they hear us talking about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're going to dive right back into the Cannes Film Festival, covering the winners where women made history, my thoughts on the best films, at least the ones that I saw, and the segment Michael just can't wait for, a look at virtual reality, which happened to be in Cannes.
I am excited.
During our book filter segment, Michael will talk about The Honeymoon from Hell, complete with a plane crash and piranhas. That sounds like a movie I saw in Cannes. On Inside Baseball, we'll give another look at the TV upfronts and everything we learned about the state of television. We promise this time, unlike last week, we ran out of time. And here's a question, Michael. If this is the era of peak TV, how come everything the networks are trotting out seems so boring? But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. We're looking at box office around the world. We pull our chart from ComScore, and then we build on that with information from Variety and The Hollywood Reporter and Box Office Profit and Mojo, you name it. And when we look at the box office around the world, the number one movie is Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales. Maybe the franchise is dead, but it's still going to make close to $1 billion. And it had a nice opening weekend with $285 million worldwide.
I loved the New York Times headline for their review on this, A.O. Scott's review. It said, Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales, at least not well anyway.
Yeah, and some people said, oh, well, they're expecting overseas. They're going to have to make up for North America because of the opening weekend. And it's like, well, no, they expected that all along because that's been the story of Pirates of the Caribbean and the Fate of the Furious, the Fast and the Furious. These are international movies. That's where they make their money. And that's going to be exciting.
Well, and if you listen to Dave Hollis, who is the head of distribution over at the Walt Disney Studios, all he could talk about was, look, we were making a global movie. Okay, so at the end of the day, yes, it didn't make as much money in the U.S. as the previous one. It made more than the original, obviously, which opened to $46 million in the U.S. But we are making a movie for the entire world to see. In all of his comments, he kept underscoring that.
Well, every studio can underscore that because you don't make a movie for $200 million, which is what we're talking about with big franchise flicks, without intending to make money, make a movie for the world. It has to make money overseas or it's not going to work. You know, that is the story of Hollywood today. It is not about North America. It would be like looking at the box office of Texas to determine how your movie is going to do. That's why we focus on the worldwide box office. And looking back at the charts, number two around the world is Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, $33 million over the weekend, $788 million worldwide. A couple things here. It has passed its original box office worldwide, so it's made more than Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 1, as you would expect. And a movie that really clicked in North America. It's doing great. It's made $333 million here, but it's also outpacing its overseas grosses. So they really introduced this movie with the first one, and now they're building on that success with the second one. So they're still hoping, of course, to get to $1 billion, almost $800 million in the bank right now. So it's a possibility, but we'll have to see where it ends up. At number three is a movie that isn't doing that well. It's Baywatch. $27 million over its 5 or 6 day. I mean, it started on Wednesday, and they were hoping to do that to help, you know, beat out some of the other movies by getting an extra day or two of grosses in there. It started on Wednesday, which I guess means Tuesday night screenings. And now it's Monday. We've got the final numbers for today. It's a $70 million movie. It stars Dwayne Johnson and Zac Efron. It spoofs an American TV show that was a worldwide phenomenon. So we're in one territory. They would have liked to have made more in North America. Comedies don't travel well, but it's Dwayne Johnson, who is about as big a star as there is right now, given all the movies he's been in. So I would not worry yet too much. It needs to make like $200 million for it to be in the black, at least from box office alone. But Baywatch was a worldwide phenomenon. At one point, it was the most watched TV show in the world. Thank you, Pamela Anderson. And, you know, there's a chance that this comedy is one that could translate overseas.
But now, the Baywatch that I am familiar with from television was not a comedy.
Well, it had humor.
Yeah.
No, this is a spoof of the show, of course. Yes. They did not do a straightforward Baywatch. Is that a problem?
No, not at all. I mean, the parts that I saw of this film, and I saw about 15 minutes of it at CinemaCon. It was funny. It looked really funny.
Yeah, well, you know, our friend Aaron Rich, our in-house theater critic, saw it and said he does not understand why it's gotten so pilloried by critics. It's obviously not a good movie, but he said it's fine. It's kind of funny. It's better than you would think.
Right, exactly.
At number four around the world is a movie that is better than you might have expected, Alien Covenant, a rebound from Prometheus. And yet this one is faltering a bit at the box office. It's in 78 territories. Over the weekend, it made $24 million. It's at $160 million and counting.
You know how we always ask, how many territories can you be in? How many territories are there? Well, if it's in 78 territories, that is the most territories I think I've ever seen.
No. There's like 80 or 90 I've seen them on.
No, but at one time.
I've seen us have movies in 80 plus territories, I think.
Yeah, they're like all those you know, Harry Potter movies have to open like that, right? I mean,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, like Star Wars, I'm sure Christmas will be in 80 plus territories.
Right, exactly.
So at number five is a movie that is an out-and-out flop. It's King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. $13 million over the weekend, $120 million worldwide. And number six is Dangal, the Indian film that has really torn it up in China. That made $10 million over the weekend. It's at $225 million worldwide. And number seven is Get Out, the horror flick. $7 million on the weekend, just about to hit $250 million all in. And number eight is Diary of a Wimpy Kid, The Long Haul. $6.8 million on the weekend, $16 million total so far. It's in 18 territories, actually. Maybe the Wimpy Kid franchise has been spreading out overseas. I hadn't noticed that, but they are in a couple countries, and we'll have to see where that ends up. And number nine is Everything Everything, a young adult disease romance combination. $6 million on the weekend, $22 million worldwide. Beauty and the Beast has a story. It made $5 million on the weekend. It's, of course, made a ton of money worldwide, $1.2 billion. But in North America, it passed the $500 million mark. It made $500 million in North America alone. The movie cost $160 million to make, and they went into the black just from North America.
That is, these days, almost unheard of.
Well, it's almost unheard of ever to gross $500 million in North America. That's a lot of money.
No, I mean the going into the black just in North America.
Oh, for a big, big, big franchise movie? Yeah, it is, because the money doesn't work that way. You know, it's a lot of money, $160 million.
Can we just go back to number nine for a second, which was Everything, Everything. You called it a young adult disease romance movie. Is that a genre? No,
it's absolutely a genre. The Fault in Our Stars. Believe me, I see a lot of young adult novels and kids who are facing mortality and then fall in love for various reasons. It is an absolute, you could have a library shelf filled with books coming out every week on that topic.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, no, it's a real thing. At number 11 is Snatch, the Amy Schumer film, $5 million on the weekend, and it passes $50 million. We mentioned the Fast and the Furious franchise. Well, the Fate and the Furious made another $4 million. It's at $1.2 billion worldwide. It also has a story to tell. It passed the $1 billion mark internationally. In North America, it's only made $220 million, which is actually a well down. Each Fate and the Fast and the Furious movie keeps dropping a little bit lower than the last one in North America, but it keeps making more money overseas. Only 30 films in history have grossed $1 billion worldwide. This is one of them. Only six movies worldwide have ever grossed $1 billion internationally when you take out North America. So it's one of only six films in history to gross $1 billion overseas. Avatar is, of course, the first one that springs to mind as being one of the others. But that's heady territory. We have two movies on our chart that are in theaters right now that are among the 30 films in history to gross $1 billion. And we could have a third one making it 31, looking at either Guardians of the Galaxy 2 or Pirates of the Caribbean.
Well, now, when you think about
it, the last two Pirates movies grossed $1 billion each.
Well, when you think about it, okay, you have 100 plus years of film history, right? So yeah, to have two films on the charts this week that have, you know, both grossed $1 billion out of the 30 in history, obviously this is just going to happen. $1 billion is the new $100 million.
That's right. In North America, when you made $100 million, you were a blockbuster.
Right.
And when you're spending $200 million, you got to gross $600 or $700 million just to get in the black, at least from box office alone. Of course, we always know there's a lot more money to be made on DVD and Blu-ray and rental and on demand and selling to cable and satellite companies and premium cable channels and TV networks and all that stuff. So we know that that's not the total story for finances when it comes to movies. But when you roll the dice and spend $200 million, it sure is nice to gross at least $700 million at the box office. But yeah, if you look at the list of 30 films that grossed $1 billion, you're going to see it heavily weighted towards the last 10, 15 years. That's where it's happening. We're going to hit 100 movies in the blink of an eye. That's for sure. Number 13 is The Boss Baby. That's at $475 million worldwide. At number 14 is a film that I couldn't quite figure out what it is. It's called Our President. It grossed $4.2 million this opening weekend. And I think maybe it's a Korean documentary about their presidential campaign, but I'm not, you know, one from the early 2000s, but I'm not exactly sure. And if anybody knows what this movie is and they can inform us, contact us. How would they do that, Sperling?
Well, they can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. Or you can look us up on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox. And our page should come up. You can leave us comments there, and we will get back to you.
Three more movies to talk about on our chart, which is more extensive than that. And number 15 is God of War, which opened to $4.2 million. And no, this is not the long gestating adaptation of the video game, but a Chinese period action film about the military in 16th century China protecting villagers from those Japanese pirates that keep raiding their shores. So probably won't make a lot of money in Japan.
Can I just go back to Our President, because you asked about this movie?
Oh, yes. You figured it out already?
Well, not to prevent our listeners from writing in. Maybe
I looked all over the place. How'd you do it?
Well, okay, here's how I did it. I looked up CJCGV. Okay, this is CJ is the Korean, South Korean company, and CGV being one of their subsidiaries, and they have movie theaters here in the U.S. I think maybe they have three or four now. And I said, well, they must be showing it because they usually build their movie theaters in parts of the country that have a Korean population. So yeah. Here is what Our President is about. It is a documentary, 109 minutes long, from director Lee Chang-jae. In 2002, Millennium Democratic Party elects the first presidential candidate by introducing a popular election system.
For their nominee. Yeah.
Right. While politicians like Ki Rae-seong, whose name I just mispronounced, have joined the election, Ro Moo-hyun, the very last candidate with only 2% approval, throws in his hat. This is the story of a nation and the nation he led. So I guess
he won the election. Yeah, absolutely.
He went from nowhere to being the president.
So it is that documentary that I discovered and thought perhaps that was one. There were a couple other movies and I just couldn't nail it down. So thanks for doing that. But if you've seen it and you liked it, again, let us know.
But who knew that the U.S. would try to adapt that movie into reality?
At number 16 is Dee Dee's Dream, a Chinese rom-com written and directed by Kevin Chai. It's about a would-be actress and a noodle shop owner who cross paths. Kevin Chai, by the way, is a TV actor, kind of making his leap to film as a writer and director. So we'll have to see where that one ends up, but it's an interesting leap for him. And I think the movie cost about $1.5 million to make, so he's off to a darn good start. And then scraping down towards the bottom, way at the bottom, and number 24 on our list is Rodin. This movie opened up in France. It was intensely disliked at critics, but thanks to Khan holding the line, it did get a theatrical release, and we'll have to see if it actually ends up making money. But it opened to $685,000. Now, that may be on two screens in France, so for all I know, that's a remarkable tally. But based on all the people who saw it and didn't like it, it's probably not going to last long.
Well, as I learned to pronounce the name of this film in Cannes, it's Rodin.
Rodin.
Yeah. And what I can tell you is that, look, I can understand a lot of French when it's spoken to me or in films. I don't have to read the subtitles sometimes. With this film, I asked other, French journalists, I said, listen, is it just me? But I could not make out a word that actor was saying. And the actor who's playing Rodin, the actual sculptor, it's a kind of
it's a biopic.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a biopic. And they said, no, he is known for kind of swallowing his words. We couldn't understand him either. We had to read the English subtitles most of the time to figure out what he was saying.
Oh, that's very funny. I'm in New York. I saw a musical set in a country that our military is occupying right now. And I learned basically because of the actors were saying this way, I assume it must be the way people in that country say it. It's Afghanistan. Forget the G. No G. They don't use the G. I can't imagine how else they would end up saying Afghanistan. So I just assume that must be the right way to do it.
Yeah, well, all the stans, we say Stan, but it's all Afghanistan.
No, it's the G really that I was focused on. Instead of Afghanistan, it's Afghanistan. Yeah. There's no G.
Okay,
that was the big thing for me. But yeah, Stan Stun. But anyway, you were at Cannes, and we do have the big prizes. So I can't wait for your reaction here. The prizes were handed out by Pedro Almodovar and his jury. They rarely match up with the critical consensus because why would they? It's five or six people who make films as opposed to hundreds of critics who are reviewing them. But the Palme d'Or has been handed out, and it's a movie I think you liked. It is The Square, a Swedish film that is a follow-up to one of the best films of a year or two ago, Force Majeure, a movie I quite liked.
Yes, I mean, look, I can totally see this movie. I'm fine with this movie winning, actually.
And that doesn't happen very much.
No, look, Ruben Östlund, you mentioned he directed Force Majeure. Everybody loved Force Majeure. This film, I felt it was overly long. A lot of critics felt it was overly long in Cannes, and they, kind of got a little muddled toward the end, but ultimately was a very good movie and probably definitely one of the best of this year's festival. So it actually winning as a consensus choice, you can see why. I mean, it had some wacky moments in it at one point. Well, I won't give it away, but there's something that occurs where you go, oh my God, how did that happen? Like, there's just, you kind of, like, it's completely surreal. So there's your Pedro moments, okay? There's some wacky things about the museum that this particular, the lead character is a curator at a museum. And it's about what happens after his wallet and mobile phone and cufflink, he gets robbed. What stems from that and his decisions based on that incident, how that can affect one's entire life. It's a good film. It is a very strong film.
Well, I'm excited to see it. And, I'm not at Cannes this year, but of course I look at all the coverage and I look at the critic grids on Le Film Français and Screen International, and I looked for it on IndieWire, but they didn't do it this year. But I definitely sense by looking at all the roundups of some of the major critics that the movie that the Europeans absolutely loved was the French film 120 Beats Per Minute, and that won the grand prize, the second place award from the jury.
Right. Now, here's where we start getting into what I like to call the politics of award giving. I just made that up as I was speaking. But, here's a film that I actually had to go. I did not see it at the morning screening where all the press gets to see it because I was, off at a panel discussion. But that said, I went to see it because people came out of it saying, look, you really have to see this film. And it's a film about it's set in the 1990s, and it is about ACT UP Paris, the founding of ACT UP Paris. And, I asked the people who told me, look, you really have to go see it. A couple days later, hey, remember you told me to see that film? What do you think of that film now? And they said, yeah, I guess now, yeah, the more I think about it, the more I realize, okay, it was an okay movie, but not a great movie. However, it's about a very important subject.
Doesn't matter. Who cares?
Well, you, when you're handing out awards, sometimes that matters, and it's the
same. It shouldn't.
It shouldn't. I totally agree, but it often does. For instance, let's look at the best director. It was given to Sofia Coppola for The Beguiled, which was beautifully shot and beautifully acted and well put together, and people, they generally thought, oh, this is a solid movie. We don't know why it's here, but it's...
I did not get solid. I got meh. at best. Most of the reviews I saw were pretty poor. It was not a well-reviewed movie at Cannes.
Well, I think we had the conversation beforehand. I did not get to look at all the reviews after our conversation, but the three or four that I read were one was off the charts, a rave.
I'm looking at 20 or 30 reviews. Sometimes when you're there and you speak to the same three people, when they all love a movie, you think everybody loved this movie. Or if the New York Times reviews it, everyone says, oh, the movie got great reviews, just because it's the Times. But I'm telling you, looking at 30 different reviews, this was a poorly reviewed movie.
Which it does not deserve to be poorly reviewed. Does it deserve to be in Cannes? There's a question. Maybe not. It's not an important movie.
You think it's a good movie?
I thought it was a fine movie. I thought it was
fine. How many is out of 4 stars?
I would say easily 2.5, 3. And I'm a very hard critic.
Well, that's a big difference, 2.5 and 3, you know. Yeah. You recommend people see this movie because I haven't seen a good, you know, you recommend people see The Beguiled.
Yeah, I would say go see it, yeah. I mean, it's definitely, you're not going to be disappointed.
Then why are you objecting to Sofia Coppola winning Best Director, which was what your next thought was?
Well, because you have some other filmmakers that easily could have won at Best Director, both male and female. However, this year, when you have Jessica Chastain and Maren Atta, whose film last year was Tony Erdmann, and everybody thought was a shoo-in for the Palme d'Or, did not win the Palme d'Or, but you could see Maren Atta and Tony Erdmann, you know, look at the way Tony Erdmann was put together, it's kind of wacky and you know, had a little offbeat, kind of like The Square, but there was, you know, they made a statement by selecting a female director. It's only the second time in the history of the festival that a female filmmaker has won that award.
The last time was in 1961 with Soviet filmmaker Yulia Soltseva. Is it an L or an I? Soltseva. For The Chronicle of Flaming Years.
It's Soltseva.
Soltseva. Thank you very much. That was 56 years ago. Good Lord, that's a long time. But why not Lynn Ramsey? She got a tie for screenplay, and that seemed to be a film that a lot of Americans and Europeans liked a lot as well.
Yeah, I noticed that both last year and this year at Cannes, the programmers are kind of, because they know people have to leave, especially from the U.S. and from countries that are, you know, like Latin America, because it's a long trip to get back. Okay, it's, you know, you basically, it's a day and a half to get back. So they start leaving at, you know, Thursday, Friday. And normally those films aren't, in years past, haven't always been the greatest. Okay, so the journalists leave knowing they're not going to miss much. Well, last year you would have missed Elle. And this year you would have missed two films. Okay, one of which you just mentioned was the Lynn Ramsey, You Were Never Really Here. And the other was the Fatih Akin movie.
Right. Also not well reviewed, though he's a director I love. And that won Best Actress. So the Lynn Ramsey film won Best Actor for Joaquin Phoenix. And the Fatih Akin movie won Best Actress for Diane Kruger, who was a German actress, but making her actual first lead performance in a German language film.
Now, let me ask you something. Why did you say it wasn't well reviewed? Because all the reviews I read of it, and I read about 5 because I wasn't there, wanted to see what people were saying. They all said, look, this is not a masterpiece of a movie. Don't get us wrong. It's a procedural, but it's a strong procedural and she gives a good performance. That's basically the gist of all the reviews I read was it's not, you know, Apocalypse Now. It's not a great movie, but it's not a horrible, horrific movie. It's a fine procedural movie.
Well, Fatih Akin is a great director and has made some absolute world-class films, some of the best of the year when I've seen them. This movie doesn't seem to be that well-reviewed. I'm saying it's not well-reviewed because I looked at critics' grids covering 30 different critics. I read Variety, Hollywood Reporter, IndieWire, and your reviews and Stephen Garrett's reviews and other people's comments. And the strong critical consensus is that it's not a good movie.
I mean,
you read 4, I read 35.
Well,
that's why I'm saying
you
it.
You read or did you?
If they give it 1 star, do you think I need to read the text? And I don't, you know, I'm just saying I looked at 35 different reviews coverage of the movie. I'm not saying they're essays on the film I pored over. I'm saying I looked at 35 different critics, a lot of major critics from a lot of major places. That's what the grids are for. And Le Film Français and Screen International and then the trades and the people I know. How is that? I don't know what to say. You read 4, I read 35.
Well, you know, In the Fade is the name of the film. The Guardian says, ninja heroine Diane Kruger marooned in feeble revenge drama. So,
people, yeah, there yeah. You go. And that's not included in the 35 I read.
Right, because they didn't participate.
The 35 that I looked at. I don't know what you're arguing about. The third place was Loveless, the Russian film follow-up to Leviathan, which might have been a contender for best film. That also was a movie very strongly liked, I think, by a mix of American and European critics.
Yes, I am really surprised that that film did not either, A, win the festival outright, the Palme d'Or, especially given this year, or win the grand prize, which would be like second place, which is where Beats Per Minute went.
Mm-hmm. Did you see the Camera d'Or winner?
I did not see that.
And another movie. There you go.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I guess that's a Russian movie that you're referring to.
No, it's a French film. It's a young woman, Jeune Femme.
Oh, Jeune Femme. Yes,
Jeune Femme. It's a French film about a young woman after her breakup, directed by a woman who filmed the movie while she was pregnant.
Yes. Okay. Yes. I've got to be honest. When you see that many movies in such a short period of time, and they're in different, you know, sidebars and different categories, you begin to, they all blend together after a while.
You have to keep notes, otherwise you get a little confused.
That would almost make me professional, which I refuse to be.
And there was a special award for Nicole Kidman for most acting.
Yeah, I mean, she was basically there the entire festival. She was in Killing of a Sacred Deer, which won, what did it win? Screenplay?
Best screenplay.
Best screenplay. She was in Top of the Lake. She was
The Beguiled.
I think she was in one other film.
How to Talk to Girls.
Oh God, that's right. That's right. How to Talk to Girls. So I did see that film, and it's wacky. You know, it's a John Cameron Mitchell movie.
Well, I haven't liked any of his movies since Hedwig. Did you like it?
I haven't liked any of his movies since Hedwig, either.
Well, there you go. So it's not a good movie.
It's one of those movies that as you're watching, you're like, yeah, I can appreciate it. It's based on a Neil Gaiman short story. I can appreciate it. It's set in the 1970s punk era. And it's, yeah. And then, like, you know, again, much like Beats Per Minute, you ask 5-6 days later and you're like, oh, yeah, no, I guess, yeah, no, that movie wasn't so great.
Well, Tom McCarthy, I think, summed up what a lot of critics felt, that it was not a very good con. I, of course, insist everybody says that every damn year. And yet, when I walk away, if I've seen 35, 40 movies, I end up having 3 or 4 movies on my best of the year list. Todd McCarthy said, by God, I had to even go beyond the competition films to find some good movies, to which I say, you always do.
That is true. That I agree with, because there are films that are in the festival that, are, you know, it's a filmmaker that the festival likes, and they'll program that film, even though it's probably not going to be very good. It usually isn't. So, yes, you do have to actually go far astray to the Director's Fortnight, to the Critics Week, which are down the Croisette, to actually see all of the great films. But unlike in years past, I would have to agree it wasn't a very strong year. It wasn't a 2003 where, like, you know, everybody was wondering why they were even bothered to show up at the festival. But, you know, it's not a year where you have Carol and The Blue is the Warmest Color and, you know, where you have like 3 movies where you just walk out going, oh my God, that was amazing. There was nothing like that.
Those were not on my best of the year list, by the way. However, if you did go to Director's Fortnight, you might have seen The Rider, which a lot of people thought was one of the best films of the festival set in America. There was a great documentary about a guy going across America in Elvis Presley's car. I forget what that's called. In certain regard, the big winner was A Man of Integrity, an Iranian film that sounded very interesting. And they also had the Taylor Sheridan film Wind River, which sounded like a fun movie. And
well,
the Critics
fun,
Week,
fun. I, you know, look, it's a movie about
a movie that's well made is fun.
Okay, well, Taylor Sheridan, he wrote Hell or High Water. He wrote Sicario. He's directing. Movie stars Elizabeth Olsen as an FBI agent who shows up on an Indian reservation to help Jeremy Renner, who is playing a fish and game warden, so to speak, a U.S. fish and game warden. To solve the murder of a teenage Native American girl. And it is it's a strong, strong movie. It veers off a little bit, but you can tell this guy, Taylor Sheridan, he is one to watch, without a doubt.
He's not one to watch. He's already here. He's written some terrific movies. And he wasn't there at Cannes, but he did hand off a speech to Harvey Weinstein, who read it out and echoed what he said, talking about the friendship of the Arapaho and Shoshone tribes that welcomed them and decrying the cuts by the government in support for them. I'm just in the middle of reading a biography by Sherman Alexie, the young adult author, and the abject poverty in which he grew up living on the res is kind of shocking and upsetting.
Yeah, I mean, look, you didn't have Carol or Blue is the Warmest Color on your end of the year list, but there was no Tony Erdman this year where you walked out going, "Holy, I got to see that again. It was so great." 2.5 hour German comedy. Let's see it again. I mean, there just wasn't that particular moment this year for myself.
Yes, there was.
I know what you're thinking. I know what you're thinking. Okay.
There was that particular moment, and I'm excited to hear about it because my objection to talking about virtual reality has never been the idea that it might become something, but people talking about it before you could even buy goggles in the store and anything to watch. Well, now we're there. My brother owns virtual reality goggles. He uses them in his basement. It's starting to spread. You're finding it more and more often in newspapers and magazines creating virtual reality shorts to tell stories about, you know, the Antarctica. And now we have a film at Cannes. It's not a replacement for narrative film where you sit down and watch a movie any more than movie replaces radio or radio is replaced by TV. It's a different thing, a different beast, just like video games are a different beast. Virtual reality is here. Serious people are making something out of it, something new and different. It's a different experience than going to a narrative film. And you did that. You went out of town to a warehouse to see a film by Iñárritu. It's like 6.5 minutes long, and I can't wait to hear about it.
Well, okay. So a couple things. You said a film by Iñárritu. Iñárritu, you know, Alejandro González Iñárritu, two-time Academy Award winner as Best Director for The Revenant and Birdman. And that is probably the only reason that this installation, this VR experience, okay, that is the key word here. It is an experience. It is not just virtual reality. You're not putting on goggles in your basement to play a video game, which is one form of virtual reality. This is, from start to finish, an experience. It was outside of Cannes. Cannes, it was kind of like a sidebar of a sidebar for Cannes. The only reason it was there, I believe, is because of Iñárritu, who has had films at the festival before. He's a friend of the festival, so to speak. So Thierry Frémaux, you know, I'll kind of put this whole thing together. And it was an installation. And by that, I literally mean an installation. It was set up at the airport, the very tiny airport in Cannes, or right outside of Cannes, in a warehouse where they normally, it was an airplane hangar. You had to schedule a time to go see it. You had to be approved. You had to then take a car to, you know, they had cars set up that would take you the half an hour outside of the town to go, which, by the way, it was probably a 5-minute drive, but thanks to traffic, it was a half an hour. It felt like I was in Los Angeles again. But you arrive at this hangar, and you were immediately given a piece of paper. And this piece of paper had, it was a waiver that in very small writing told you numerous ways you could die, feel sick, that VR was, you know, it could be deadly, basically. So please do not hold the festival or anybody responsible. And in this cavernous warehouse, there was kind of a you know, it's kind of hard to describe, but it was obviously a maze that looked like a maze that was set up, an installation that was set up that you could not see past. It looked like a big giant border wall. In fact, what you were looking at was a border wall just 4 months ago. It was corrugated steel that had been taken off of the border, originally used in Vietnam, but then moved to Arizona afterwards to make up a border wall. They then took that down, used it in the installation. The U.S. put up concrete barriers instead of this corrugated steel. But as you're sitting there waiting for your turn to go into whatever this VR experience is, you are listening to what sounds like a helicopter, the rumbling of a helicopter, fans, all this noise. I mean, it's making you paranoid because you've just signed your life away. You're hearing these electronic ding, ding, and you don't know where that's coming from. And you're sitting in this vast space with this wall that you know something's behind it because it's making a hell of a lot of noise and shaking the rafters. And then you are told, okay, it's your turn. Sure. You are walked by an usher, so to speak, an attendant, to read about the corrugated steel. And then you're told, okay, just walk down this little pathway here along the wall and into that door. And you walk into the door and you are greeted by a floor full of shoes in a little tiny space. And you're told, okay, take off your shoes, take off your socks, and please put them in the locker on the wall. And you do that. Then you turn around and you see, oh, there's another door here. You're told, when the alarm sounds, please enter. And it's one of those smoke alarm, you know, with that flashes that you would see. It's in, you know, commercial industrial smoke alarm. And eventually It goes off. You're sitting there barefoot at this point, just waiting. All the shoes that are on the floor are from, they were picked up in the desert as migrants crossed the desert and died. They would find shoes, backpacks, you know, all sorts of belongings. Those shoes are from somebody who went about picking them up. The alarm goes off. You open the door and you're staring into an expanse. It's a huge, giant square. Pitch black, except for one long orange light and a floor full of sand. The entire floor is sandy. In the distance, in the center of the room, are three silhouettes. One of them holding a backpack, the other holding goggles, the third one holding headphones. And you can't see their faces. And you're basically, you just kind of naturally walk toward them because they're the only thing in the room and you figure you have to. And one of these silhouettes actually approaches you. He's going to do all of the talking. He says, "We're going to put this backpack on you." They put the backpack on.
How heavy is it?
Not very heavy at all. And they say, "Okay, we're going to put these goggles on you. Do not put your hands over the top of the goggles because there are sensors on the top of the goggles that tell us where you are in the room and help the experience progress. And we're going to also put on these headphones so that you can hear. You can walk around anywhere. You can walk throughout this room. We will be with you so that if you get too close to a wall, you'll just feel a little tug, just like, you know, and they kind of pull a little tug on the backpack. And that'll mean, hey, don't walk any farther. Do not run, okay? Do not run anywhere because you may be closer to a wall than you think." And they basically make it sound like, look, people are running because this is so scary, okay, that you are going to run. Essentially, the experience begins, and it is, you know, ILM helped do the special effects. It is a border crossing, and you're with a whole bunch of, you hear all of a sudden you're plopped into the middle of the Arizona desert, and everything looks incredibly real. You can walk around and turn your head to the left and right and look down. The only thing that's a little disconcerting is when you look down, you have no feet. But other than that, it looks like you're really there. As it's kind of nighttime-ish. And all of a sudden you hear voices off in the distance, and they approach. It's a bunch of migrants crossing, a bunch of refugees crossing the border. And one of them's injured and they're speaking in Spanish. And then all of a sudden come the border patrol and they're pulling up in their cars and a helicopter. And that's that noise that you were hearing, the helicopter landing nearby, and the wind all of a sudden is blowing. And meanwhile, you're stepping around on sand. Okay. And it's so lifelike and so real that I decided, you know what, I want to step in between, because you could be anywhere. You could be with the migrants trying to cross. You could be with the border patrol by their cars. I decided to step in between the cars, the border patrol cars, and the immigrants that were crossing. And your shadow is cast across the scene because you're in between. That's those sensors that are picking up where you are in relation to where the scene is taking place. There's a whole little moment where it becomes a little surreal, where there's a table and, you know, the coyote who's helping everybody cross is, you know, I'm not going to go into the little kind of scene that plays out within the scene, but it is very lifelike. Only when you get close to any of these characters that are actually portrayed in this piece, all of which were actors, sorry, not actors, but actual migrants that did the crossing. So they played themselves with motion capture. Only when you get close do you see how digital their faces are. They're very, very digital.
So, what do you mean by close?
When you actually take a step toward them, you can stand with your face an inch and a half away from their nose.
Right. So what do you mean by close that you can see they're digital? Like a foot away, you can touch them, or you're like 5 feet away, or how close?
I tried the whole touching thing. Obviously, that did not work. I tried touching a table in that surreal moment where it was kind of like a dream sequence. But you can literally, I mean, I just happened to stand behind the border patrol, and it was as if I were one of them. I mean, you could really be looking over their shoulder it was in 3D. Everything was in 3D and not the kind that makes you sick. It was really done very well. This is by far, like I said, the best virtual reality experience I have ever witnessed. And all it took, Michael, all it took was a multi-million dollar production and a giant museum installation, because that is what this is. This will be a museum installation.
In Los Angeles.
In Los Angeles at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. Right now it's opening in Milan. Eventually it will be in Mexico City. So the whole thing ends on, you know, it's there is no plot, okay, other than, you know,
it's an experience.
Yeah, the migrants get taken away, and then all of a sudden it becomes day. Now, one of the things I said, well, what would happen if one of these people walk through me? Like, can I walk into somebody? Well, when you stick your head into one of the characters, you can see their beating heart. That was kind of cool. Like, it would all of a sudden it would flash, and you'd be looking at a beating heart. Or if one of them walked through you, you'd see the same thing. I heard there are different, like, Easter eggs where, you know, you can look into one of the backpacks that the migrants are carrying. It's, you know, nobody will experience this VR installation in the same way, including yourself. If you went through it again, you'd have a completely different experience.
And some reporters said that they felt like they instinctively went towards the guards like you did, because they wanted to subconsciously identify with them and not be the person that was being harassed or having the guns pointed at you. Said, I'm going to be over here. I'm going to be with the guys with the guns, because, you know, it seemed safer.
It's funny that you should mention that. I did both. I was with the guards and then I walked through, because you're told, lie down, everybody lie down. Obviously, you don't want to do that when you have something over your face, right? You know, so I thought about, kind of kneeling down, and I thought, well, if I do that, then how am I going to get up? And so I decided not to. But I was in both places. But as I was leaving, I thought it would be an interesting social study to see who goes where. How many people do side with the guards and do wander over to the guards? How many people do just stick with the migrants and the immigrants? And what ethnicity are all of the people who do either? It would be interesting to see that.
Well, I think 30 years from now, you'll look back at a list of events and things that were at Cannes, and you'll say, oh, that's right. Carne y Harina was at Cannes. That's amazing.
Yes, this, I have to say, you know, Michael, you were saying, look, you know, oh, it was a poor year for movies. Oh, it was a, you know, people are saying it's a poor year for movies. And as you say, Michael, every year there's like one or two, maybe even three, where you look back at the end of the year and go, hey, I saw that in Cannes. Yeah, that's right. It was worth seeing that. And certainly it was great to see it in Cannes. This year, between the argument over Netflix and whether a movie that, you know, is going to premiere Netflix, whether it should be in the festival, which, by the way, side note, notice how none of those films, either Okja by Bong Joon-ho or The Meyerowitz Stories by Noah Baumbach, none of them won any awards. Whether it was that issue, whether it was the issue of should TV shows be premiering at film festivals like Twin Peaks and Top of the Lake, both of which premiered at, they were shown within the festival, or this VR experience, you can see how film is becoming, well, just part of the crowd. It's one of the art forms that's in the crowd. It's no longer the dominant art form, but it's an art form along with VR, along with television, along with streaming. But I will agree with you, Michael, going all the way to Cannes this year, sure, the films weren't as good as they usually are, but that experience, that Carne y Harina experience, and Michael, you know how much I love VR, and I say that sarcastically, that was worth it.
Well, very cool. I'm jealous, as I always am when I don't get to go to Cannes, but I'm sure you're jealous because I get to read a lot.
You do, actually. You get to read way more. In fact, I was trying to read a book on a plane coming home. I had 12 hours. I thought I could finish. I thought I could, but I was so tired, and I was just so sick, still trying to get over my head cold from Cannes, and I couldn't read. I thought Michael would have been done with five books by now, and even worse, he probably, most likely, would have already written them up for Book Filter, because yes, indeed, it is time for our Book Filter segment. Book Filter is a book lover's best friend, and every week, Michael, you pick through hundreds of books, but for us, you pick a few that the industry should be paying attention to, and maybe even optioning to turn into, well, movies or television shows, or dare I say it, VR experiences. What do you have for us this week?
Well, there are two big comic works out this week. One is a new book by David Sedaris called Theft by Finding. That's obviously going to be very popular. And Al Franken has a biography about being in politics, and it's called Giant of the Senate, which already makes me laugh every time. Al Franken, Giant of the Senate. I smile every time I see that. He really purposely tried not to be funny for his first stint in the Senate. He wanted to make sure his constituents knew he was focused on them and focused on their issues, which he still is. But he now, I think, feels more comfortable and free to be amusing. And so those two books are going to be big bestsellers. But the book I singled out for Hollywood, and in fact, it would make a good VR experience, is Ruthless River. It's a paperback original, and it's a memoir, kind of a travel book, I guess, about a husband and wife who, after they're married for a few years, go on their honeymoon experience, which is what a lot of people do. They want to have an experience rather than getting a tea set. You know, they say, hey, help us do this crazy thing. And they were going on a year-long round-the-world adventure. And it's written by Holly Fitzgerald, and she and her husband went on a trip. They're flying over the Amazon, and their plane crashes, landing at a penal colony, which is probably where you don't want to land. They survive. They end up building a raft out of four logs. They go down the river. They go through Peru and Bolivia. They get trapped finally in a dead-end area after hundreds of miles where they can't get out. They're going to have to get off the raft if they want to get anywhere. And what is the river filled with? Piranhas. Yeah, they have to stay on the raft and die, or swim through piranhas and try to get to shore, and then still try and get away. Obviously, they're still alive. Apparently, they're still married. But it's a paperback original. It's catching on with readers. It's got some really good reviews. And hey, I was thinking movie, but maybe it would be a good VR experience if you really want to be scared.
I do like, you mentioned a giant of the Senate. I like the advertising campaign or the tagline for this book. It was in the New York Times book review section this week where he said an award-winning comic makes a run for the Senate and quickly realizes why award-winning comics don't do that. But yeah, I have noticed that Al Franken lately has been a little bit more humorous. Puckish. Yeah, he's during one Senate panel, I actually heard him say, I used to have a career in kind of highlighting the absurd, and what you're saying is completely absurd. Kind of referencing his own former comedic past. But as always, Michael, certainly I appreciate the two selections for this week. But that wraps up our book filter segment and moves us along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, change happens slowly in late night TV, but sometimes it begins in the blink of an eye or the tousling of some presidential hair, or shall we say presidential candidate hair. The New York Times did a lengthy piece about Jimmy Fallon's dark night of the soul as he realizes that playing cutesy with a Mussolini-like fascist promoting hate on the campaign trail has not endeared him to viewers, even if that candidate went on to become president. And now CBS and Stephen Colbert have ridden a hot streak since the election, took the wind out of the Tonight Show's sails, and they've won the season in total viewers for the first time, get this, Michael, since 1995. Yes,
wow.
Yeah, 22 years ago, that David Letterman won late night by being a pain in the neck to his bosses because he was always ragging on CBS. Now Colbert has done it by being a pain in the neck to the president. So kind of, still same concept. You're still being a pain in the neck. Fallon still wins among 18 to 49 year olds with a 40% bigger rating than Colbert. And NBC believes this too shall pass. Big deal or big whoop.
Well, I think it's a big deal because 22 years, my God. But Colbert is up 11% and Fallon is down 15%, and he's not done falling yet. So it is more than just Fallon falling. Colbert has actually been gaining. And the interesting thing is that DVR has been a really big factor here. Colbert is really racking up points on DVR usage, which has not been very typical for late night television, but it is now.
Well, I also noticed that the LA Times, the New York Times, all of these media outlets are saying, what happened on late night last night? Where they actually kind of give you the monologue or the good bit that everybody will be talking about today or tomorrow. And so that really has helped because it helps me go, it's 11 o'clock. I'm just going to stay up a half an hour later. I'm going to catch Colbert. Or I'm going to, I'll watch The Daily Show, and then when that's over, I'll just catch the first, 10, 15 minutes of Colbert and see what he's ragging about these days.
Well, that's funny. I saw that as more just these major outlets trying to catch up with what bloggers and other people have been doing for years. But in fact, you're right. When you cover something, then people are aware of it. Just like in books, when the Times removes the romance charts or mass market paperback charts, those books are less visible.
Right. Well, and I do agree with you, Michael. They are doing this. The New York Times, the Washington Post, they're doing this whole let's cover late night. They're doing that because that's what bloggers are doing, and they're looking for hits. They're looking for clicks. Yeah. They're looking for traffic, and it's working.
Let's do video.
Us? You and me?
No. Well, yeah, sure. But I mean, they like, let's put in a video of a late night thing, you know?
Oh, yeah. No, that's true. Yeah. No, I mean, I would say I kind of wonder what's going to happen to Colbert, you know, if Trump ever, you know, at some point Trump won't be there and Colbert probably still will be. What is his shtick going to be? His whole thing right now is wrapped up in kind of bashing Donald Trump. So without Donald Trump,
well, he was successful during the Obama era too.
Good point, but he was successful kind of as a character, a caricature, in fact.
He'll be all right.
You know, speaking of another character, the comic book superhero Wonder Woman is coming to the big screen, and some people think she's sexist. Not the women who objected to the 1970s TV series in which they showed off Linda Carter's assets and sang in her satin tights, fighting for our rights, and the old red, white, and blue. Did they really sing that, by the way?
In her satin tights, fighting for our rights, and the old red, white, and blue, Wonder Woman.
Oh, I never really actually paid attention to the lyrics. I just like the...
I know what you were paying attention to. Keep going.
I think I was paying attention to... Oh, never mind. No. Okay, so obviously, it's a handful of men objecting to a public screening of the upcoming Wonder Woman movie that men were not invited to. How dare they? It was a stunt by the Alamo Drafthouse. They thought it was just a fun idea to promote a film of particular symbolism to women and vowed everyone there, everyone at the screening, would identify as a woman. They'd either be a woman or they'd identify as a woman, including, by the way, the projectionist, to which I ask, what's a projectionist? Do they still have those? I guess they do. The company's Facebook page was flooded with comments, most celebrating the screening and some denouncing the chain for prejudice. Luckily, Alamo Drafthouse was sporting some indestructible bracelets, and they deflected the criticism as easily as Nazi bullets. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's an amusing event or stunt, and I think people basically took it in the spirit in which it was done. It was not done to black out men, and it was just one time, or now they've added a few screenings. It's just for fun. Yeah. And someone said, hey, have you ever officially held a screening just for men only? They said, no, not officially, but we did screen Entourage.
Right. Well, here's my question.
I thought that was funny. And I said, they've had women-only screening before because I went to Magic Mike, and believe me, I was the only man there.
It's the unofficial women-only screening. But what about, like, you know, would they be crying the same way if it was Sex in the City?
No, I think so. I think it's the same point. But, yeah. But it's the spirit in which it's done, not to keep men out, but to have a fun, offbeat, you know, the 10 p.m. screening is this. It's just goofy fun. It's not meant to point out someone else's. We can't have the sexes be together at a screening. That would make a different vibe. But superhero movies, of course, get a lot of attention. And people are excited for Wonder Woman. And there's some sad news about Justice League. The director, Zack Snyder, stepped down from that film to be with his family after his daughter's suicide. Who was it who stepped in to take over the ending of the directing of the film? I forget. It's
Joss Whedon, who of course
made
a name for himself with Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Marvel's The Avengers.
Yes, so a very sad reason for that change in movie, but that's what's happening in Hollywood.
Yeah, I mean, there's not, you know, we're not going to kind of... what's shocking about it is, you know, certainly the suicide, without a doubt. That takes precedent, and as Zack Snyder and his family he's doing the right thing. It's time to be with his family. As he said, look, at the end of the day, it's just a movie. A great movie, but it's a movie, and I've got to be with my family. But it is very rare for on one of these big budget movies for a director to publicly step down and hand the reins over to another director. Good news, it's a good director, it's Joss Whedon.
Yes, no, it is very unusual, that's why we mentioned it.
Right. Now, actor T.J. Miller is also leaving. He has left the hit critically acclaimed HBO sitcom Silicon Valley and won't be returning for the fifth season. He's pretty busy parasailing into Cannes to promote the animated film The Emoji Movie, for example. He's also got an HBO stand-up special premiering in June, a role in the Steven Spielberg sci-fi flick Ready Player One, reprising his role in the Deadpool sequel as well, not to mention a Western, a thriller, and maybe even returning to another series called Crashing for season two. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, of course. It's just his own change in career. I was tempted to list all the people who left hit critically acclaimed TV shows, which is rarely a good idea, especially when you're looking at the fourth season. It's not like it's season 10. But, you know, Shelley Long leaving Cheers, McLean Stevenson leaving MASH, David Caruso leaving NYPD Blue, everybody who left Barney Miller. Boy, that was a shame. But has to be said, they're not leaving with like one idea in mind. He's leaving with 10 things on his plate. So I guess he'll be okay for a while.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the way the Hollywood Reporter covered this story, they made it seem like, no, you know, he was not leaving of his own accord. That's effectively the way that they covered this story. That he
I wondered about that. It, you know, they quoted saying the producers and he have mutually agreed he will not return for season 5. But then when you list the 27 things he's got going on, it's very confusing. If there's more to this story, because that really there's no good reason to leave the show.
No,
I mean, I don't care what you got on your plate. When you're lucky enough to be with a really good show that's critically acclaimed and continuing, it's just, why would you ever want to walk away from something that good? You know, if you think it's run its course creatively, sure, but that doesn't seem to be the case here. And I was wondering about that worrying, but he has so much going on. I thought, well, maybe there's some, maybe there isn't some other story. So maybe we'll hear something in a week or two.
Yeah, well, there's always, look, you know, he was a big part of Silicon Valley. I mean, he played one of the main and more important and interesting characters on that show.
It's right, so what the heck is going on?
Yeah, it's a 10-episode arc. You know, there's only 10 episodes or 12 episodes tops per season. So, you know, there's always been some question about, you know, his drinking or his personality. I've actually, you know, met him several times, and he is wacky and insane, and you almost kind of wonder, like, what are you on, my friend? So I don't know if that carries over to the workplace, then maybe, yeah, maybe it's a little bit easier to work without someone like that.
Well, thank you for casual gossiping. So you're saying it's drug or alcohol abuse that has led to him being dismissed from the show.
That was kind of alluded to, not only in
not
this story.
Not in the statement.
Not in the statement. No, not in the statement. Not at all.
Well, where did it come from other than your personal speculation?
It's more my personal speculation.
All right. Well, let's not do that unless we have some actual hard reason to think so. That certainly is what one would immediately jump to the idea of, that he's either too much of a jerk to work with or he's got problems. He's got a lot on his plate, though, so hopefully if he does have any, he'll take care of them.
Yeah, and that's really, quite honestly, I wasn't talking about drug or alcohol. What I was saying is, yeah, there may be a personality issue here.
You know? After 4 seasons, he's so insufferable. All right.
Who knows? Former One Direction member Zayn Malik, talk about personality issues. He may be paying the price for breaking up the biggest boy band in the world. Malik was the first to debut a solo album, and it hit number one in the US and many countries. But now Harry Styles has debuted his first solo album, and it's getting more sales, more streams, and more critical love, all for embracing an early 1970s rock vibe, or as some would say, stealing an early 1970s rock vibe. His album
sold... You can't steal it. You can't steal it.
I know. I'm just, you know, hey, I'm just going with what people are saying. He sold almost 200,000 actual albums. What's an actual album? And hit 40 million streams for all of its songs. Up next, Niall with a single pegged as sounding like Glenn Frey of the Eagles. What the... And by the way, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Is it Niall? It's not Neil?
Oh, it's probably Neil. But since I didn't follow One Direction.
I think it's just pronounced Neil. Yeah, yeah.
You know what? I didn't follow them at all. So to me, I was like, this is all a big whoop. Who are these people?
If your daughter was only a little bit older, you'd know everything about One Direction.
I'm kidding. Of course I know who they are. But I've never actually, to me, they're like a blob. I don't really know one from the
other. Like I said, if your daughter was a little bit older, you would know everything about One Direction. They wouldn't just be a blob.
Right. I mean, Harry Styles always stood out. But all the others, it was like, Harry Styles and the other people from One Direction.
No, I was always a Neil fan myself.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, so there you go. The band is broken up. They're doing it. Maybe they'll come back together someday. I imagine we'll have the One Direction comeback tour. Why not? But it seems like Harry Styles is doing what Zayn Malik said he wanted to do. Zayn felt constricted by the One Direction pop format, and he wanted to be more rock and out there. And Harry Styles was like, I can do that too. So a little comeback, I guess, for him. But again, I don't know why they're trying to convert streaming into sales and sales. It's like just...
Oh, let's not even go into it.
The new metric is streaming. Just stick to it.
Director Steven Soderbergh said he was going to retire from directing films after he was done with some current projects. Michael and I had a running bet that we couldn't actually fulfill because both of us agreed that he would never give up directing, so nobody would take the other side.
Someone else to bet against.
Yeah. Now he's inked a deal with Amazon and wonders, does streaming count? Because if it does, then I didn't retire. Actually, the movie Lucky Logan will get a theatrical release in August and then hit Amazon in early 2018. That's not a bad little method of, you know, distribution. It's a heist film starring Channing Tatum and Adam Driver. Soderbergh has also signed a 2-year first look deal with Amazon on theatrical projects. Is Soderbergh going back on his retirement pledge? And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop because we knew it would happen. But my question is, when you sign a first look deal with a studio, you get an office. What does Jeff Bezos give you? Like free shipping for a year?
Yeah, you get Amazon Prime, but one day, not 2 day. Disgraced baseball player Alex Rodriguez. I love the way we've written that. Disgraced baseball player. We're just like lobbing that title onto him. Alex Rodriguez.
Well, we have the public facts to back it up.
Well, yeah, he basically was suspended not once, but twice for using performance-enhancing drugs. So I guess you could say in that regard, he was, well, at least punished. He will never get into the Hall of Fame because of that after cheating repeatedly throughout his career. And he'll probably never make Dad of the Year since his marriage ended acrimoniously with tabloids linking A-Rod to numerous women and his wife citing the player's infidelities, to which I think all of us would go, you're shocked by that? And yet, Fox Sports has A-Rod as a baseball analyst, and now ABC has inked the slugger to a long-term deal. He'll pop up on Good Morning America, World News Tonight, and Nightline to discuss, what, like, sports? Well, yes, but really, A-Rod hopes to weigh in on stories about families and financial planning. Of course! Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop. I mean, why? What in God's name are they thinking? You know, when you're not sure how to invest that extra $100 million, turn to A-Rod. You know, it just, but again, when people get exasperated that people cheat and they lie to their teammates, the owners, the fans, and they do it repeatedly, and yet do they pay a price? No, not really. Well, you know, ABC wants to associate themselves with a guy who cheated on his wife to talk about family. And he wants to associate with a guy who stole money from teams by lying, stole money from other fellow players and cheated them with, you know, getting contracts for performances he couldn't have done on his own. And he gets rewarded with it with tons of money. And they want him to advise people on financial planning. A guy who cheated throughout his career repeatedly. They want him to provide analysts on sports. Oh, let's get the cheater to talk to us about sports. It's like having Pete Rose on your show to talk about, you know, the latest baseball game.
Well,
it's
funny that you should mention that.
It doesn't make any sense.
It's funny that you should mention that because if you recall, last year during the World Series in the playoffs, you had A-Rod and Pete Rose, okay, together on the same panel discussing the games afterwards.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And it was actually, they did a good job. Like, putting all of their past beside, okay, which, yes, I agree with you, is you kind of wonder, like, how did you make that decision in the first place to put those two together and at all on television? But yet, putting that aside, they actually did a decent job of analyzing the game. Now, again, I agree with you. Financial planning? What are we talking to Alex Rodriguez about financial planning and family stuff for? You know what? You want to talk about whether the pitcher was pulled too soon? Fine. But, you know, I don't need to listen to you tell me about where to put my money. But from one controversial issue to maybe another, because in theater, the idea of a diverse casting in classic shows like those by Shakespeare is so common that it hardly merits comment. But when a playwright refuses to allow colorblind casting, hackles can be raised. A regional production of Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf gained national attention when its director posted on Facebook that the Albee estate forced him to fire a black actor hired for one of the lead roles or shut it down. Now hold on, says the estate. The director never even had the rights to do the play, okay? Always knew the estate insisted on approval of all casting and knew that Albee's wishes were that these roles in particular should not be done with actors of different races. Albee also blocked an all-male production of the play. Everyone agrees it's his right to do so, but is he right? And I guess we're talking about Edward Albee. Or was he, since Albee is dead, and it's his estate doing the refusing? And, by the way, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop because I think everyone agrees colorblind casting works and is a great thing. For some shows, maybe it doesn't make sense or it can bring something new out. But if you look at Edward Albee's other plays, like in the West End right now is The Goat or Who is Sylvia? There are two black actors playing roles that were originated by white people. There's a lot of diverse casting in a lot of his shows that they are happy to have happen and even encourage. They just feel like in this show, he doesn't want the particular emphasis that it would be if you made it all male. because it's obviously seen sometimes as a coded gay play, which Albie says it's not. And he thinks if one of the actors was black, that would just, you know, the character's described as Aryan, and they comment about his blonde hair, blue eyes repeatedly.
Right.
And so to have him be played by a black actor would be a little confusing. Some people say it would bring up stuff that would be interesting. Others say it makes no sense. That's what he wants, and that's going to happen. I think down the road, clearly you're going to have it loosen up and more things will be done to toy with it. But given the context of his happiness to have diverse casting in a lot of other plays, this seems like just a principal choice that the artist wants, and it makes sense.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, it could be done well in the future. I'm sure it will be. I'm just saying this is what he wants, and they're still in the shadow of him having just died recently, and therefore that's the way it is for now. I'm sure someday we'll see that casting, and that'll be fine too.
Yes, I agree. It's more narrative than it is discriminatory.
Right.
The American Idol saga continues, by the way, Michael. FYI. I don't know if you were aware of that. ABC has snagged its first big host for the relaunch of the talent show, and it's pop superstar Katy Perry, as we had predicted. It cost a pretty penny, though. The singer was very happy to obliquely confirm she had a big payday and was getting more than any man.
Like $25 million a season.
Yeah. Of course, one reason the show made no sense to Fox as ratings fell was the huge salaries demanded by big stars like Jennifer Lopez. We also know that talks are dragging with Ryan Seacrest. His people let out the detail that Seacrest has been offered $10 million to host, but insists he's wary of committing until he believes they've got the right team and right plan in place to make it great. And of course, the logistics getting him to LA or the show to New York seem insurmountable. Damn right, says Kelly Ripa. You're not taking that guy away from me. I just built a studio for him in the back. He is not leaving. Big deal, big whoop.
We got to get her on the show.
Yeah, so she can do that instead of me.
No. Yeah, I love you. You're doing a great job. I think it's a big whoop. I don't see how it can come to New York. I don't see how he can go to L.A. It's crazy. You know, but they paid big bucks for Katy Perry because they lost Kelly Clarkson. They were really working hard to get her to be on their show. I don't know that she'd necessarily be good at it. We've seen her be a coach on The Voice and do stuff on The Voice before. So, you know, maybe she wouldn't. And who knows if Katy Perry can do it. But they needed a big name and they got it.
Well, and you know what? They could do the show in New York. They do it at the Beacon, maybe even Radio City Music Hall. I don't know. But it's doable. I mean, it's not like, you know, L.A. is the only place.
They said it would cost more. They said the cost would be exponentially more.
Well, that is probably
true. And I'm
like,
really?
That is probably true due to unions and rental. Yeah, that's probably true. But would it be?
But you've got unions in L.A. and you can get tax breaks in New York.
Yeah, that's true. You know what? Somebody write into us and let us know why it would cost that much more. Come on, people.
Yeah, I would think, you know, you could end up, the finale would be Madison Square Garden.
Right.
You know, go from the Beacon to whatever to Madison. I mean, why not?
Yeah.
I don't see why it couldn't be in New York. That to me, I don't identify the show with L.A. as such. I identify with America. You know, they go to all these different cities and then they have the big finale. So to me, it's all about the national things, all these different cities. And then they come together for finale. To me, that's not L.A. That's just a big place.
Yeah. Now, certainly, when it comes to Ariana Grande, I think it's safe to say that at least for, well, the next decade or so, her name will always be associated with Manchester, England.
Well, hopefully in a positive way that she's reaching out. She's going to do a benefit concert there. It's a dreadful tragedy, and hopefully they can turn it around and have some positive, happy things come out of it, if that's even possible.
Yeah, and the it, of course, is, you know, 2 weeks ago or last week, there was the bombing at the end of her show in Manchester, and she did say, hey, we postpone the tour. We'll be starting it up June 5th with a benefit concert at Manchester. Probably a smart move on everybody's part, but unfortunate it has to happen at all.
Yeah.
But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, Michael, I'm going to turn it over to you because, frankly, I was in camp. I got no idea what's going on. I know TV still exists. I know that much. I know that there's going to be some new shows and some old shows and some shows I can't find anymore on what is going on with the TV?
Well, there's a lot of new shows. We're basically talking about the fall season. So CBS has 6 new shows. ABC has 5. NBC only has 3. And Fox has 3. And the CW has 2. And when you add it all up, you've got 11, 14, 17, 19 new shows. But you know, they weren't kind of exciting. You look at them all and you're like, yeah, there are reboots and shows you've heard of before, or they just sound very familiar, or they just sound like procedurals. But you know what? There's an additional 24 new shows scheduled for mid-season. And I think the reason the fall season seems a little meh is because it's a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week, 365-days-a-year business. They've got new shows in summer. They've got new shows in mid-season. The excitement is not all weighted to the fall. In fact, most of the new exciting shows are coming in the mid-season or in the summer. So the action is not in the fall anymore as such. That's still when they, you know, do the dog and pony shows and get advertisers to lay down a lot of money. But there is just a lot of stuff happening all year round now on network television.
Well, what I think is interesting, one thing that you kind of point out here is that Twin Peaks, which, of course, the first two episodes of the reboot were shown in Cannes because David Lynch is a big Cannes filmmaker, and he did this television series back in the 90s, okay, and he's bringing it back now, and so he brought two episodes to Cannes. They also wanted David Lynch there for the big 70th, anniversary event, which he was. But you mentioned that the Twin Peaks debut back in, when was it, 1990, 91? It reached 36 million people for the pilot of the original series. Now, mind you, that was in an age where you had, I think it was 57 channels, as Bruce Springsteen says. Now you have 570 channels to watch. And, of course, streaming to contend with. 600,000 people viewed the pilot of the reboot.
And they added about another million with streaming. So more people watched it on demand or on their DVR than watched it when it aired. That's just a new world we live in. Even 1.7 million people, which is what they're up to now for the first two episodes. I'm sure that's far below what Showtime was hoping for. But they say, no, we're thrilled. People signed up to get Showtime just to see this series. And that's what we want. We want subscribers who stick with Showtime. And that's what matters to us, not your silly metric about who made what.
Right. Now, what I would say is also you're comparing broadcast television, okay, when it was on, you know, I think it was ABC, if I'm not mistaken.
Uh-huh.
Could be. To, you know, premium cable. So, of course, more people saw a television show in the early 90s debut on a broadcast television network than premium cable.
Well, not as well. I mean, HBO's Game of Thrones is practically the number one show in the country right now. That reaches 26, 28 million people. It's clear the numbers are down from that era. I mean, you know, and certainly the percentage of people watching is a lot more small. You know, there aren't as many people watching even the biggest shows now like there used to be. But you can reach 26, 28 million people with Game of Thrones on HBO. So there's no reason why Twin Peaks couldn't have been a lot bigger.
Well, you know, the number of people that I heard say the following in Cannes about Twin Peaks. Hey, do I have to remember the original Twin Peaks, which was some more than 20 years ago, or do I have to have seen anything like Fire Walk with Me, the movie on you know, the Twin Peaks movie? Do I have to know anything about Twin Peaks to enjoy this reboot?
No, because you won't understand it anyway.
I was just going to say, did you understand it back in the 90s? Because nobody else did. I heard that probably 10 times. So,
well, here's looking at the fall network season and the shows we see for mid-season and going on. Here's the big takeaway. One, reboots are not stopping. We've seen it in movies since movies began, sequels and remakes and things like that. TV's had them for a long time, but boy, it's gotten really notable how much they're leaning heavily on it. It feels a little exhausting, but it's never going to go away. But vertical integration, I think, is the really big story. Everybody wants to own the show. The networks are making the shows that they themselves create. That happens more and more and more. We knew it would happen when it was made possible, and it just keeps happening more. If they don't own it, they want at least a piece of it. That's just the reality. And why is that?
Well,
because, as CBS says, they're not making money in first run. They are making more money from owning a show than from displaying a show. They make more money on the back end. For the first time in history at CBS, less than 50% of their revenue is from advertising. They're making their money on owning the shows and what happens when they sell that show overseas, have their second airing, can sell it on DVD or Blu-ray or on demand, sell it off to people like Netflix for rentals so they can have access to it. That's where they're making their money. That's where most of their money comes from. It's the back end more than the front end.
Well, and you know what many would point out is, let's take Twin Peaks. In the 90s, you would that first running of an episode, you would basically break even. on the production costs. Okay. And that was a good goal. If you could break even, you were doing pretty good because you know you'd air it a second time. The rerun of the episode would then make money. That would all be gravy because you'd already paid for it. So all of the advertising on the rerun, which usually happened later in the year or during the summer, it was all money earned. The problem that you have now, and I'm sure I don't need to tell anybody this, is what's a rerun? Nobody does reruns that much anymore because, let's face it, you can catch up on Hulu or there's always catch-up TV. It could be streamed. You've DVR'd it, so it doesn't matter. There are no reruns. And certainly from a syndication standpoint, that money has, I don't want to say it's dried up, but it's not nearly what it used to be.
Well, there's still money being made in syndication. I think more importantly, there's a lot of money being made selling TV shows overseas. And that's a big revenue stream. It's always been around, but I think it's a much bigger factor than it's ever been before because there are so many countries more developed with cable, more channels to bid for them, satellite on demand. There's more ways for people to access those shows, and they've become a lot more valuable. So the big money, it always moves around. It used to be first run advertising, then it used to be syndication once you hit 100 episodes. Now I think a lot of it is coming from overseas. And everybody said pay TV was dead. Right? Everyone's going to cut the cord. Nobody needs TV anymore. Nobody wants it. By the way, according to one study, it looks like pay TV subscribers, people paying to access television, is going to hit 1 billion people or households, I guess, worldwide.
Yeah. Well, you know, certainly you're right, Michael. There's always been a huge market for selling television shows overseas. It's gotten much bigger over the past 10 years, maybe 15 years. But let's face it, we've talked a lot about Cannes on this episode of Showbiz Sandbox, but MIP TV, M-I-P TV, is a conference that has always existed to do just that, to sell TV shows internationally. It's held every year in Cannes just before the festival.
And it's not just American shows being sold overseas. We're talking about British shows being sold in America and all over the world, Australian, French, German. We're seeing more and more of these shows playing in more and more territories as people, I think, have now fully gotten over the idea of reading subtitles. It still doesn't happen a ton on television, but I think it happens more and more all over the world.
Yeah, I noticed that when the series Lost, remember they used to have subtitles on a regular basis on Lost, and I thought, wow, they're just not caring. They're like, no, we're going to throw subtitles at you on a network broadcast show. And it just kind of never was an issue. People were fine with it. Now, mind you, it wasn't for a majority of the show, but still, I think that helped kind of push the idea that audiences were willing to read at least some subtitles.
That's right. But that ends Inside Baseball and leads us right into the obituaries because it's been a busy couple of weeks and we didn't cover them last week. There's a lot of names to go through.
Well, first, any one of these. We can start with any one of these.
Is there anyone that you have something useful to say? To tell you very quickly, actor Roger Moore, who played James Bond, died at 89. Brad Gray of Paramount, he died of cancer at 59. Roger Ailes, it's only been 2 weeks, but all this happened. Roger Ailes, the former head of Fox News, died at 77. A woman you won't know about, but her name is Nora May Ling. She's a Broadway actress and star, but her claim to fame is helping inspire the original Forbidden Broadway, which is an off-Broadway spoof of shows. And she helped make it happen with creator Gerard Alessandrini. She helped pay for it. He and her chipped in hundreds of dollars to make the original show happen. There's a cool obit in the New York Times about her. Greg Allman of the Southern rock band the Allman Brothers died at 69, and Chris Cornell of Soundgarden committed suicide at the age of 52. So a lot of people passed this week. Is there anybody that you have a personal connection to or story about?
Well, Brad Gray, certainly, you know, having worked in the talent agency and, you know, talent representation business in the 90s, he was kind of a legend. You know, he was a founding member of Brillstein Gray. Founding member, that sounds like it's a band. But he was one of the major partners at Brillstein Gray. In fact, the firm was named in part after him. And they represented a lot of big name talent, including Brad Pitt, by the way, who he then formed Plan B Entertainment with. That was the production company that went on to make, War Machine, for instance, which is premiering on Netflix this week, as well as Moonlight. I think they also produced Moonlight, and they've produced a lot of films, 12 Years a Slave. He went on, he left the talent representation business to go and head up Paramount. And he really fought to keep his job there at the end. Just this February, he stepped down after the whole Sumner Redstone and the Redstone family kerfuffle, which really is still going on, in my opinion. And he was kind of bought out of his contract. And after heading I think it was 12 years, he was the head of Paramount. People knew he had cancer. They didn't know how sick he was. He passed away less than 3 months after stepping down from Paramount. But he was known as being smart, hardworking, and would always know, he always knew talent really well.
Well, that's cool. And I have no personal connection to Roger Moore, but as a fact checker guy, there were one or two things about his obituaries that caught my eye. And just as a guy who hates when people puffs people up just because they died, which I think is not really honoring them. The first thing is, do you count Sean Connery in Never Say Never Again as a James Bond film? I mean, I don't care what the Broccoli's say. You know, it's like, do we care? Is that how you say their name?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I don't care what they think. Do we count that? Because if you count that movie, which was made without their official stamp of approval, to me, that's a real Bond film because it's Bond in a serious Bond film. You know, you wouldn't count the David Niven spoof Casino Royale, but you would maybe count Never Say Never Again. If you count that, both Roger Moore and Sean Connery made 7 Bond films. If you count that, Sean Connery played James Bond over a longer span of time. But all the obituaries said, we're going to ignore Never Say Never Again. The Broccoli's will come after us. And they said he made more movies because he made 7 to Sean Connery's official 6. And he made them over a 12-year period, which is longer than anyone else has been Bond. So full credit to him for that, depending on how you slice and dice it. But then there was one obituary that says something like, Roger Moore was much more than just the Bond. And it's like, no, he wasn't. He really was his Bond. You know, he did The Saint and he did James Bond, and that's what he's remembered for. And that's not rude to say that. You know, he wasn't like Sean Connery, who had a great big career outside of Bond. He's Bond, and he was comfortable with that, and he did good stuff for UNICEF and other people. You don't need to like puff him up and pretend he was suddenly a Shakespearean giant. He was just a light actor, looked good in a suit, and he did James Bond well. You know, more power to him. Few people get to say anything like that. There's no need to exaggerate or pretend he was somehow some far greater and more complex actor than what he was. He was a movie star, and he wore celebrity well, and by God, he's James Bond, and that's all you'll remember about him. And for almost anyone in the world, that would be more than enough, and I'm sure it will be for him.
Now, if you're wondering how to pronounce Broccoli, just always remember this. It was the Broccoli family. They not only are the producers of the James Bond franchise, but the family that invented, guess what? Broccoli, the vegetable.
Okay.
That's how to...
Wow, I hope they patented that.
Couldn't tell you.
Well, on that note, surely we're done with the episode. Once we're getting to vegetable jokes, it's time to say goodbye.
That's true. But you know what? I want to thank all of our listeners for being patient with us last week when I was deathly ill in Cannes, had the wrong equipment. It took forever to get the episode up. So thank you for being patient, not only with how long it took to get the episode up, but then once it was up, the fact that really my end of the conversation didn't sound as good as it normally does. Of course, no matter when we posted the show, it would always appear in your podcast feed if you subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free and aggregate podcasts. You can subscribe to the show, rate and review the show, and every new episode will wind up on whatever device you use to listen to podcasts. And we do appreciate it when you rate and review the show. It does help us out. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us or contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter @ShowbizSandbox is our handle. You can like us on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page should show up. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week I look forward to hearing what it is. What website do you have for us this week, Michael?
This week it's ilikebroccoli.com.
Okay, that's a reference from seconds ago. Okay, I like it too. I like it just fine. If you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there on that particular website, which I'm sure actually does exist, you can head on over to the Huffington Post, or I don't know, michaelgiltz.com has all of his entertainment coverage. Don't forget to visit bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.